welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark Abell. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Mike.
We're going to talk today about preterm birth. Preterm birth technically refers to the delivery that occurs between 20 and 37 weeks of gestation. 70 to 80% of these preterm births are spontaneous due to preterm labor. The remaining 20 to 30% are iatrogenic. Preterm birth is relatively common. Somewhere between 15 and 20% of all births worldwide fit into this category. Some of the known risk factors include a history of premature birth, maybe drugs, genetic factors, race, age, prior cervical surgery, and some other factors. Ideally, identification of modifiable and maybe even non-modifiable risk factors for preterm birth can be identified to allow for interventions that might help. Few interventions have been proven to prolong pregnancy in women at risk. The goal has been elusive for several reasons. Two-thirds of those with premature births occur among women with absolutely no risk factors. Causality has been difficult to prove, and there's no adequate animal model that exists for us to study preterm birth. Regardless, you found an article that was published in Lancet that you're going to review for us. It attempts to answer the question, does low-dose aspirin starting early in pregnancy reduce the incidence of preterm birth among nulliparous women with singleton gestation? Mark, is something as simple as an aspirin going to help this?
You know, sure, it would be nice if it did. And this study was done in six resource-poor countries, India, Pakistan, Zambia, Zambia. It's the Gambia, but it's just Zambia. Democratic Republic of Congo, Guatemala, and Kenya. The authors enrolled about 12,000 nulliparous women, at least 14 years old, all with singleton pregnancies. And they randomized them to 81 milligrams of aspirin or placebo, starting between 6 and 14 weeks of gestation and continuing until 37 weeks or delivery. Women were excluded if they were allergic to aspirin, if they'd previously used aspirin during this pregnancy, or if they had more than two first trimester pregnancy losses, in which case they shouldn't be on placebo, or medical conditions that might be considered a contraindication like diabetes or hypertension. Further screening required a blood pressure less than 140 over 90, hemoglobin of at least 7, and a viable fetus without anomalies. So these were normal, nulliparous, singleton pregnancies without any other complications. About 85% of the women were at least 90% adherent to the treatment based on pill counts. So that's good adherence throughout. Preterm birth before 37 weeks occurred significantly less often in the aspirin group, 11.6 versus 13.1%, number needed to treat of about 66. They looked at about 20 secondary outcomes and treated them as exploratory because there were so many peeks at the data. Among those outcomes that were significantly better in the aspirin group were early preterm delivery before 34 weeks, fetal loss after 16 weeks gestation, and up to 7 days postpartum. And there were no differences in the overall incidence of hypertensive disorders, maternal bleeding, or fetal growth abnormalities. No statistically significant harms of aspirin treatment, although the study wasn't powered to assess some sort of a very rare catastrophic outcome. Still, with 12,000 patients, it certainly would have detected any important, relatively common complications. So bottom line is, the routine use of low-dose aspirin, 81 milligrams a day, started as early as 6 weeks, did significantly reduce the incidence of preterm birth in nulliparous women with singleton gestation in resource-poor countries. No significant harms were seen. It isn't clear whether the results are generalizable to women in more advanced economies. There may be differences in diet. There may be differences in, you know, availability of healthcare resources and other treatments. So it may be premature to generalize that, but it's certainly very interesting research.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge study, 12,000 people. And, you know, in terms of diet and lifestyle, the countries that you named, India and Pakistan, very different than the DRC, which is very different than Guatemala. So mm-hmm. they do have a diversity of cultures and foods and diets and climate. And anyways, I guess what you're suggesting is it's not quite a practice changer in North America yet, but it deserves some attention.
Yeah, I mean the benefit was modest. I mean, I would say the number needed to treat is 66, but it's a catastrophic outcome when it does occur, or potentially catastrophic. And I think it's very promising. It's possible that the net benefit might be a little smaller in more advanced economies, just given better access to healthcare, but there may still be a benefit. That's one of those kind of gray areas where do you apply this now or do you wait for a similar study in, Europe and North America? That's a tough question.
Well, thanks for bringing that to our attention. A very interesting study. We'll talk with you again in a week.
Sounds good.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.